Use the mic.
That's great.
Good evening, everyone. I'm David Alkeck, and welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. This evening we have with us Dr. Catherine Schaefer. A few little announcements. First of all, any newcomers, any first-timers here? Yes, where did you hear from us, about us?
Meetup.
Great. Yes.
Google.
Ditto? Okay.
Google.
Oh, Google.
Yeah.
Wow, very good. All right. Well, welcome. You'll find this is a very educational experience, hopefully. And we meet the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month, January, let's see, September through...
May.
And then we skip the summer months and then start over January. We have two models of meaningless lives in 2 weeks. Living on the hinge of history after that. The Edge of Tomorrow, Philosophy and Artificial Intelligence by one of our very own. Fake News versus Real Reporting by a professor from the School of Journalism. And the American Dream in History, Politics and Fiction. Make sure that you pay our treasurer your $5 entrance fee. And if you're a full-time student, it's $2 because we do have our expenses too. And please don't forget to take care of your wait staff if you've eaten or drunk anything tonight. And please, tip them because they have to live on that. So tonight we have with us Dr. Catherine Schaefer, who was born in the Chicago area, is that right? And reared there. Went to school, I've got her BA from the University of Illinois in Urbana. Her master's degree in teaching from the UTD here in Dallas, and Doctor of Education from Dallas Baptist University. She has presented nationally for the Advanced Placement College Board. She serves on the Texas Education Board of Gifted and Talented Students, currently serves as Executive Director of Advanced Academic Services and World Languages in Carolyn Farmer's Branch. So, join me in welcoming Dr. Catherine Schaefer, who will speak on philosophy, politics, and the culture of education, preparing for the future.
This is the first time I'm really presenting some of this information. And so my intent when I started was to have a very nice linear conversation to come to a conclusion. But it became impossible because education is influenced so much today by politics, by culture, by decentralization, by destabilization, by technology, by changing demographics. There's so many different things that as I talk through, you're going to find me going in slightly different directions. So you might want to write down some questions as I'm in an area of interest for you. The U.S. model of education is decentralized. It's very different than many other developed countries around the world where national public education is supported. Many of the PISA studies that show very high performances around the world show the U.S. very low. And, you know, places like Finland, Norway, and New Zealand very high. They have nationalized public education. We're in a very different system. We have local boards of education. Schools are funded by state and local. Federal government only supports public education by 8%. And that 8% is typically for federal programs that are tied to things like food, breakfast programs, things like a special education, and those kinds of support services, and those are federal funds. But very little actually comes from the federal department. We now have, as our head, Betsy DeVos, very, very controversial person at the head of education. Quote that's important is that her budget, she says, places power in the hands of parents and families to choose schools that are best for their children by investing an additional $1.4 billion in school choice programs. So much of her influence over the next couple of years will be in school choice. That aligns with the what is going on at our state government in Austin, which is also fostering student choice. There are some important things to consider about school choice, positive and negative things that will change the face, not only the state, but change the face of those students who are going to be entering the workforce in just a couple of years. Because of school choice, we're really moving into an era of marketing. Marketing involves where are you going to grab the money from. If in public education in the state of Texas, a child sitting in the classroom amounts to about $5,000. So whether that child is in a charter public school or in a public school, that gives that school about $5,000 to work with just by virtue of the child sitting in the classroom. So you'll see a lot of marketing by charter schools because they have to fill their seats in order to make money for charter schools. There are a lot of for-profit charter schools out there. There are a lot of independent charter schools out there. They're typically smaller. They have less overhead. Public schools are still the big behemoths out there taking care of all kinds of kids. The big shift is federal government doesn't support just public ed anymore. They're supporting private schools. They're supporting charter schools. Another quote from Betsy DeVos that I read over the past weekend is that she wants money funneled to private and charter schools, regardless of religious affiliation, regardless of any other kinds of things. That's nice for school choice and for parents that kind of want a unique situation for their child to be educated in, but we as taxpayers will have our tax dollars given to charter schools that we may not want our funds funneled to. And without restrictions on open access, that really opens the door for charter schools to do many different things than they're able to even today. So capitalism is kind of replacing this not-for-profit kind of expectation of education. But on the other hand, public school now no longer is a monopoly. So we're having lots of fragmentation in educational by virtue of choice. Some of the educational theories I'm going to be talking about, these are teacher-centered theories. This is about what is learned, perennialism, essentialism, and behaviorism. Perennialism is a theory that things endure. Principles endure over time. Knowledge endures over time. It's idealist in nature. It's really about the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic with strong liberal arts, character training. It has more of an intellectual elitist approach. It's not trying to educate every child. It's not meant to educate every child because trade and skill training are for the others. This is a little bit like some of the European models. Kind of a local perennialism school would be Cistercian. I realize that's a religious school, but Cistercian believes in these kind of enduring understandings over time. Their curriculum has not changed much in the past 20 years, and they don't intend it to change. That's a perennial kind of a system. Essentialism. There's a common core of information and the skills that an education person must have. It's kind of that back to basics kind of movement, transmitting cultural heritage, transmitting good citizenship to those in the classroom. If you're at all familiar with E.D. Hirsch Jr.'s, what every kindergartner should know, what every first grader should know, what every second grader should know. He has a whole series of books about this, about the content. It's very heavy content, what content children should know. It's popular with homeschoolers because they are really very driven toward kinds of content that are important to them. Behaviorism is something I'll spend a little bit more time on, because I think this is something that's impacting so many other areas of education right now. You're all familiar with behaviorism, reinforcing positive things, negative reinforcement, the things that you want to avoid. Lots of repetition, lots of practice. In the classroom, this looks a lot like the reward system. Teachers give stickers and rewards and things. You have the green light if you have a good behavior day, and the red light if you have a bad behavior day. These are trophies for everyone. This is part of the behaviorism philosophy that's out there. Grades become very extrinsic motivation for students. Interestingly enough, a lot of AI adaptive unlearning platforms rely on behaviorism. They think like computer games do. And this is how our children are learning outside of the classroom today. Think of all the video games that are out there. They're all based on rewards and very quick incremental rewards to keep students engaged and moving forward. This translates into the classroom with what we call gamification of education. That is really very real in the classroom. Lots of teaming, lots of group activities. You're going to be in that has to do with Project Lead the Way kind of programs, has to do with problem-based learning, where you are given a group of students and you have to solve a problem. Everyone comes with a set of skills and you have to work collaboratively with other students. There's a little bit of loss of individual accountability. The behaviorism that is in education classrooms right now is because we are struggling to figure out ways to keep our students engaged. Everyone needs to be engaged every 3 seconds, like they're touching their phone. We do it all the time. The brains of children are actually different than ours were growing up because of technology. And so in the education world, teachers are struggling with how to keep their children focused, how to keep them engaged, how to keep them moving forward in a system that was really designed not for immediate reward, but for long-term reward. So there's kind of that conflict going on, and that's where gamification comes into play. Again, this has to do with video games. This is how people are learning, again, outside the classroom. By the age of 21, males in particular have spent 10,000 hours playing video games. By the age of 21, it's an enormous amount of time learning in a system where you have almost instant rewards, levels, stars, you know, character traits, you know, a cap on this character, I mean, all kinds of crazy things, okay? They thrive on that kind of motivation. It's all behaviorism. There are some student-centered educational theories I'll talk about. This is not what is learned, but this is how it's learned. Progressivism, reconstructionism, and humanism. Progressivism opposes authoritarianism, and it favors human experience. Kind of think about problem-based learning. It's the hands-on John Dewey kind of thing about if you want to build something, you go in the garage and you build it. If you want to learn about plants, you go in your backyard and you start building a garden. It's very hands-on. It looks for an end product. Actually, in classrooms today, those end products are called performance tasks or projects. Most curriculum is designed with a project or a task at the very end to show the learning. Where there are less incremental assessments, the big assessment is at the back end of it. Reconstructionism calls on education to lead the reconstructing of society. This is slightly socialist in nature. Some of this is embedded in, let's say, schools that have international baccalaureate, because so much of their focus is on the global student learner, where all cultures are explored, all cultures are accepted, all cultures have equal value. You explore controversial issues and you develop a vision for a new and better homogeneous globalized world. That's part of the IB structure. Humanism. Humans are innately good. We don't have a blank slate. Ties in with Maslow and his hierarchy of needs to self-actualization. This is where people learning in an environment of caring. Think Waldorf schools and Montessori schools. Teacher is the role model. Students are responsible for their own learning, and learners are empowered and they control their own learning at the pace of which they can accept the learning. So the teacher is the facilitator. The teacher is not the leader in the classroom. Students are leading their own learning. That is humanism. Those are some of the theories, but we also have lots of very concrete things that are happening in our world, much of which is about changing demographics. Not only in our state, not only in our city, do we have cultural diffusion. Cultural diffusion has resulted in the loss of common norms. Common norms of behavior, common norms of what education should be, what I want my child to learn, how I want my child to learn. I can tell you in my job dealing with gifted and educated parents, different demographics want very, very different kinds of programming for their students. And it is quite culturally based because many of the parents that I have in Carrollton Farmers Branch are new immigrants coming in. And so they come with a lot of desires from their home country and with their home language. And they want that duplicated in the school system. Another problem we have is children in poverty. We have 20% of our children in the United States living in poverty. That is not the case in other countries, specifically where education is nationally supported. So we have this intellectual deficit. It's called the word gap. I have approximately 62% of my students are low SES, low socioeconomic, mainly they're living in poverty. They come to us in kindergarten because many times they cannot afford preschool. A child who is born in poverty does not have the benefit of having parents giving them an enriched environment. They do not have the opportunity to hear language as a conversation. The language of poverty is very directive. Go to your room. Eat this food. It has a very different style of sentence structure than normal conversation does. So poverty children learn that kind of language structure only, and it's very limited versus what a student in a middle class family might learn and experience and be exposed to. So by the time a child comes to me at 5 years old, the poor ones, the children in poverty, have heard 30 million fewer words. That's astounding. 30 million fewer individual words by the time they're five. I can't close that gap, and I certainly can't close that gap in kindergarten. The public schools are charged with closing that learning gap all the time. You hear about that often. Close that learning gap. That's a gap I cannot fill. Now, if a child is highly motivated, yes, maybe by third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, maybe I can close that gap. But if they're not reading on level by grade three, they will never be reading on grade level. That is a very difficult thing to understand. Doesn't mean we ever give up on kids. We never give up on kids. But we know statistically, you build the numbers of prisons, beds, based on grade three below level readers. That's how many prisons you're going to need when these people turn 18, 20 into their 30s. Those statistics correlate with each other. We also have lots of, again, different values, different cultural expectations, different ways of dealing with authority in the classroom, different ways of dealing with a female in the classroom versus a male in the classroom. Things about homework and what kind of homework is appropriate. Some cultures are resistant to assimilation. They want to be with us, but they don't want to assimilate. I was raised by immigrant parents. My parents made sure that all their children were educated. English was only spoken in the home. You dress like an American, you talk like an American. We wanted to be American. That's why we were here. That is not always the case with new immigrants. They typically want to enclave a little bit, and they want to maintain their cultural language, their cultural customs, all the things that tie them to their homeland. And assimilation is not what they are striving for. There's a decline of value of education and teaching. Is the work that I do and the teachers do and all that valued? Probably not. How much, and this is even in higher ed, how much are adjunct, professors paid today? I know, it's not even, it's not even sometimes worth having a class for. I know that. There's also a very, and has been for some time, ever since after Sputnik and all that, a very anti-intellectualism in the United States. Smart students are not valued. Smart students are put down as geeks. Smart students are seen as elitist. Smart students are made fun of. Smart students are not those kids that we grew up in the Sputnik era, where those kids with the slide rulers, they were fantastic. Those are the kids who were going to run the world, and they did. But today, that child does not feel like they are empowered to do that. Specifically girls, starting in middle school, hide their intellectualism and may never come out from underneath that. The lack of common public school experience. I shared that with one of the members of the group here tonight. It used to be that public school was sort of, I don't want to call it always the melting pot, that's kind of an overused term, but it meant that there were some common experiences. It meant that when children went to college, professors knew that every kid read To Kill a Mockingbird, every kid read, Romeo and Juliet, every kid, went to a football game, had a pep rally. There were certain cultural, every kid, had a homecoming dance. I mean, there were certain cultural and intellectual experiences that professors could count on. That is no longer the case, because so much of our curriculum now is tied to community norms. My reading list is nothing like the reading list even in Plano or in Coppell or in Fort Worth or anywhere else. Everyone has their own curriculum that they develop based on what the state says we must teach. So that has its consequences as well. There's no more commonality. You can't always integrate with educated people because there's no common experiences. I think that was one of the pluses of public schools in my time. Loss of the middle class, we know about the widening economic gaps, and certainly the loss of family structure is tied to poverty, fewer intact families. This has a great impact on students who go home with no parent, who are not fed in the morning, who just don't have the norm about what success looks like and should look like, and what a single parent might want for their child. This cultural diffusion is a real challenge when we talk about educating all students, because there's, what is all? It is getting more and more and more diverse. Dr. Negruda is a professor who has come to speak in my district, and I've actually had a conversation with him. He believes in excellence for all, and we'll talk a little bit about his philosophies. He says if we do not address the profound inequalities in education between the haves and the have-nots, our entire society will be imperiled. So while I'll talk to you a little bit about Forest and Treats, and that is really tied to what he believes. He is definitely on the Forest. We must educate all to high excellence, and he has certain ways of doing that kind of go against the grain of what we have been doing in this country. So forests are the trees. There's some American mythology here. This is kind of a collision course in education, I think. The tree. Okay, the old tree. It's like the individual down here. We know the forest is made up of a bunch of trees. Okay, so if you think of that as a school classroom or a district or all kids in public ed, parents care about their tree. Parents care about their one child. They don't necessarily care about all the trees. They care about their child. Public ed, state cares about all the trees. Okay? We can't care just about one tree. We have to care about all of the trees. What Dr. Negruda is saying is we have to change the thinking of parents to not just think about their own tree, but to think about the forest. That's interesting, because that is a real shift for parents to make. This tree mythology, this individualism, actually ties back to things that that we're very familiar with in American culture. You don't find these kinds of mythologies in other cultures. It ties to the old John Wayne thing, you know, that rugged individualism, ride your horsey and, you know, get up and go on your own. Make it on your own. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps and here we go. It is kind of a social Darwinism. The best are going to survive, and if you got your grit, you're going to do it. And you keep working harder and harder and harder, you're eventually going to get there. That's kind of that American rugged individualism. Part of that is we don't want government. Government's not needed, not wanted. We want less interference. That's part of that politics of rugged individualism. Individuals are and should be self-reliant. Focus on individual success and not the group. So if you're a believer in the tree mythology and American individualism, what happens when you go to a public school or any school where now we're talking about gamification, where we're talking about STEM education, where everything is project-based, where everything is group and collaborative and not individual any longer? Yet, guess what? Grades are individual. You go to college on an individual transcript. So you see how this is all in collision. It doesn't really mesh up. You're not going to go to college on a transcript that says, I was a great member of this group, right? No, they're going to look at your you know, what's there, because higher ed is still looking at individuals. Public ed, K-12, is looking at the group. So even lower and higher ed are not in sync with each other. And then you have the forest mythology. This is the democratic ideal. And what you're going to feel, I feel, is I'm both. I'm both a tree and I'm both a forest. I'm both an American individualist and I believe in democratic ideals. So these are in conflict inside of most of us. Everyone is equal under the law and deserves equal access. No one denies that in a democratic system. Those in poverty need and demand more. That's also part of it. It's that village concept, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, okay? So we're looking for more social services, education being one of them, where parents rely on others and institutions, typically schools, to raise and educate their child, to feed their child, to have a doctor on campus, to have a school counselor on campus, to have a behavior specialist on campus, to have tutoring on campus, to have all these services are being funneled through public education because that's where we house children in this country. That costs a lot of money, okay? It also ties to cooperative learning. It's about the group, less individual. Forest mythology was really pushed by No Child Left Behind because it was a push up from the bottom. Make sure you get those kids' test scores up. So it was all about money spent on your low students to make sure that they would pass the test. Not on the kiddos up here, but on the kiddos down here. And by the way, No Child Left Behind was the brainstorm of George Bush and Ross Perot, who based it on the business model that I'll talk about in a minute. But the democratic ideal of forest mythology really has Christian values involved in it. And this is where we get into some moral conflict. I don't know about you, but I feel that. Helping the least of us succeed, that's something we want to do, that feels good to us. It feels like something that we were meant to do, we're asked to do. Okay? And public ed is really marketing toward this forest mythology, where charter schools and private schools are really marketing toward the tree mythology. And that's why that marketing is a little bit different. This one called The Great Blueberry Story. Jamie Vollmer was the CEO of Bluebell Ice Cream. Okay. He believed in the business model, No Child Left Behind, Ross Perot, George Bush. He spoke at an education conference. And he goes, you know, I just don't understand you educators. You know, I make blueberry ice cream. I buy my ingredients. I have a system. I put it through my system. It comes out blueberry ice cream, and it's the same all the time, every day. It's about reliability. It's about consistency. I don't understand you teachers. You have a curriculum. You put kids through the same curriculum. Right? Year after year, grade 2, grade 3, grade 4, you come out at the end, you don't have anything close to a consistent product. You got them all over the board. What's wrong with you? Right? You need to develop this business model. And this business model is really, from No Child Left Behind, is where all this data-driven stuff about education has come, like where our ratings are, and you know how many students have passed the state star and EOCs, and just all this kind of stuff. We are crunching data constantly. Our children are now data pieces. And that is my world. We look at data constantly as aggregate and disaggregate. So children are now about a test score. Children are now about what skill deficit do I need to fill, and can you go online and prove that you know this now to go to the next step, and then, you know, you're in behaviorism all over again. So after this conference, one of the teachers, you know, raised a little hand, and she goes, oh, I'm a kindergarten teacher. You know, God love kindergarten teachers. And she says, well, you know what's wrong with your model? And he says, no, there's nothing wrong with my model. This is what education needs to do. She goes, no, sweetheart, what's wrong with your model is that, and she stopped. She goes, what happens if you get a truckload of blueberries that don't quite meet your specifications? They're a little mushy. They're a little moldy. He said, well, of course I would turn it right back. I can't. I'm not going to. That's not mean. I need the best ingredients in order for my product to turn out that way. And she goes, sweetheart, we can't turn away any of our blueberries. She goes, what would your blueberry ice cream taste like if you had to put in every blueberry you got from anybody else? Would it be the same? Would it taste as good? You know? And it was kind of a moment for him. So he kind of, after that conference, became an advocate for public education. And so he's been, ever since, he's sort of been on this tirade a little bit about, we are asking our educational systems to do more and more and more that they were never designed to do. And I know you always hear teachers and everyone saying we're putting more money in and more money in. You just want more money. You know, you just do it with less. Well, look what we're asked to do with the same amount of funding we've really had over time. You know, PE sports, how many sports do you have to have in high school? And guess what? Every high school has to duplicate those sports. You know what that costs? Do you know what stadiums cost? Do you know what fine arts programs cost that are duplicated in every single high school? Okay. What about nutrition and school breakfast programs? What about mandated school transportation? Busing, huge. We're mandated. We must bus students. You know what that costs? An enormous amount of money. When I grew up, you paid to ride the bus, or your mom or dad took you. That wasn't a given. Full-day kindergarten was never designed from the beginning. AP programs, great programs, I sponsor them, love them, but it was never designed from the very beginning. Behavior management, psychological systems, parenting education, character education, all these extended programmings, public ed was never designed to do. Title programs now, we have to have girl sports, we have to have girl everything, you know, make sure that it's even and all this kind of thing. Preschool programs, after school programs, alternate education, gift and talent programs. The list, I mean, that's only like 1/10. Of the kind of services that we are asked to provide.
You left off the 504.
Oh my gosh, the 504 and special ed, that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning of what it costs to educate particular children. You're getting the same amount of money per child, but it costs more money depending on which child you have, what blueberry you have, right? So let's go back to the forest and the tree. Okay, parents care about the trees. Educators have to care about the forest. Parents are typically individualists that care about their trees. Forests are like public education. We want choice. Choice sounds good to us. I'm not anti-choice. I just think that there's some dangers about it. Public education by default is about the forest. Our ever-expanding needs and services, we have to care about all of them. And when you look at public ed and you look at the accountability systems that we are under, that, by the way, charter schools are not under, and when we are rated by the state, it's hard to even look at those kinds of ratings and understand that those are based on averages. You're all very smart people. You know the downside of averages. Okay? Do you know that if you have a subgroup, let's say you have a subgroup is 25 students on a campus. If you have 25 Hispanic students on a campus, that subgroup of those test scores count just as much as the other 75. Just as much, even though they're not the same. If you have 24, they're not a subgroup, they're not reported at all. Isn't that weird? Yeah. So every principal wants to know how many kids are in what subgroups, because that's going to determine so much of the accountability. Also, accountability, you have one failing elementary school in the district. In my district, we have 26 elementary schools. If we have one failing elementary school that fails accountability, the entire district is put on failing status. Is that right? You know, there are pockets and wonderful schools everywhere. So, you know, a lot of this accountability, it isn't communicated well about what it really means. So to complicate matters, so we have conflicting mythologies of trees of force and pressures of cultural diffusion and instability. Guess what? Here comes technology. This is not new. You all are aware of the economic change and international competition that's out there. These are just some examples of things. Employers express concern about lack of essential skills among American students. Fastest growing jobs require education beyond high school. International competition is alive and well, especially at the collegiate level, especially at the college level. We know that professional jobs, there's a competition with USA students versus students coming from overseas. We face a greater competition in the future than any time in our history at all. So kids growing up today are not just in competition with their own peers, they're in competition with peers all over the world who are growing up and living and thriving, many of them in educational systems that watered the individual tree, took care of their highest individuals, and these folks down here went to vocational. And I'm not saying that's the right way to go, but we're getting the best of the best from overseas, and they're competing with our students who basically grew up and are educated in a forced environment. So who are the best and the brightest, and where do we find them? Why are they not here in the United States when we hear that companies can't find what they want here in the United States? Our students aren't educated to the level that they need to be. They're not in the PhD programs. Is it the anti-intellectualism? They don't want to go into research. They'd rather go into business and make money. All these kinds of things are going on. And where will technology lead us? This is a book that I read, Homo Deus. It's a Brief History of Tomorrow, One God, and he believes in data. He believes that in the very near future, we'll have a great decoupling. Humans will lose their economic and military usefulness. Value is going to be found in humans collectively, because that's megadata. We'll be able to figure out what people want and need by looking at megadata and not in unique individuals. So he doesn't care about the forest at all, because he believes that there's going to be these educated elite that are going to run the world, run all the AI systems, figure out all the algorithms, and basically the rest of them are going to do what? And that becomes the question. Ties into Mike Zuckerberg's proponent of universal basic income. What are these people going to do that have nothing to do? What are we going to do with people? Bill Gates says our biggest worry is not an attack by rebellious robots, but a lack of purpose. And an example of this would be, if you took 100 18-year-old males today, put them in this room, and said, I'm going to give you $50,000 a year. You don't have to work ever. You don't ever have to find a job. You don't ever have to do anything. All you have to do is house and feed yourself on $50,000. I wonder how many of those 100 18-year-old males would sign up tomorrow. And the scary thought to me is they'd be happy doing it. They'd be happy doing it. That's shocking to me, and it worries me tremendously. So what are we going to do with the superfluous kind of people? What will we do once we don't have something to do? How does that affect education? We know that these jobs are going away. Jobs are going away all the time. So what do you do with all your blueberries who are not perfect? How do you educate them, and for what purpose? What do you do with your imperfect blueberries? Can you make them perfect in the process? What do you do with your perfect blueberries? And what do you do with the mix? Education specialization is very in vogue right now. A lot of districts are putting out STEM programs because students are able to go from STEM programs to college to be able to have high-paying jobs. They can support themselves. I have two engineers out of my four boys, and bless them, they are working right out of, you know, an undergrad, and it's wonderful, okay? But I'm wondering, if this guy is right, I'm not so sure he is, but if this gentleman is right, if AI is squeezing humans even out of the skilled jobs, will engineers actually even have jobs in the future? Will so many robots be taking over those jobs that the people who will be taking care of the robots will be really, really squeezed into the elite up top? And then what do we do with everybody else? So I'm not sure about specialization. When we think about specialization, we are narrowing the focus of, I'm going to go into this program so that I can get a job. Okay? So I worry about specialization because what if those jobs go away? And you don't have that job any longer. What are you going to do with yourself? So how do we educate it? This gentleman says, for humans to stay in the game, we have to keep learning throughout our lives. We have to reinvent ourselves repeatedly. But many, if not most humans, may be unable to do so. And that has nothing to do with age. It's just that the pace of change, humans cannot absorb as fast as it's going to come. So, is this truly a brave new world coming with drugs and computer games, the soma of the masses, doing nothing day after day with universal guaranteed income? Are certain pockets of our society already there? So this is a study put out by the University of Chicago with some economists, and it talks about the video gaming young male in their mid to late 20s. Who are perfectly satisfied living at home, not working, not getting educated. They are the most at risk because they are not educated. There will be nothing for them to do in the future. But guess what? They're very happy. They're happier than those who are in college. They are happier than those who are working. They are happy and very content. Very odd study. I know. 22% of men between the ages of 21 and 30 with less than a bachelor's income reported not working at all in the previous year. Not at all. Young men without college degrees have replaced 75% of the time they used to spend working with time on the computer, mostly playing video games. The trends are different for women. Women tend to go back to school.
Well, what do they live on?
They live with mom and dad. Right?
When mom and dad are gone?
I don't know, but that's you know, where they are. And going back to behaviorism, increasingly gaming is becoming more sophisticated, moving men away from the workforce with, again, this reward system that becomes addictive. And they really, there is an, you know, addiction out there that they can't actually kind of break out of it. They're addicted to an online virtual world that doesn't really exist. But that is their world. Then, first time since the 1930s, you'll get it, this is funny, more U.S. men age 18 to 34 are living with their parents rather than even with romantic partners. Like, they're not even having sex. Like, come on. Right?
Uh-huh.
Like, gaming is fulfills that purpose for them. Do you know? That's shocking to me.
Well, they won't reproduce.
They what? They won't reproduce. Yeah,
yeah.
But here's an alternative view. Again, I'm not sure this guy is totally correct either. But Fareed Zakaria, who you may know from CNN, he wrote a very famous article called In Defense of Liberal Education. To sum it up, what he says is, because the future is changing so rapidly and so fast, we really can't educate for particular skills. So what we really need to do is kind of go back to liberal education, where you are training the mind and you are creating flexibility of mind with cognitive demand of reading and writing and philosophy and all those kinds of things to lead an enriched life. So then when you are tasked to do something, you can learn it. So that is his argument. But yet, liberal education right now is totally out of favor. Who is getting an English major other than like one of my sons? And then, you know, what did that mean, graduate school? Because you can't do anything with it, okay? Students are urged to stop dreaming. You know, parents say stop dreaming. You think practically, is that going to get you a job or not? I'm going to shell out all this money, and am I going to have any payout at the end of it? You know, liberal arts students are not finding the jobs out there that STEM students and other skill-driven curriculums have. But liberal arts, what they do, they teach you to write, they teach you to think, they teach you to learn for a lifetime. You feed creativity, curiosity, adventure, risk, internal ambition. That's very different than behaviorism. And they feed ambition. Something interesting, I looked at some statistics on MOOCs. Those are massive open online courses for free. Most of your major top-tier universities have tons and tons of MOOCs out there. The MOOCs that are most in vogue and are requested are not your skill-based. Guess what? They're philosophy. They're art history. They are all the liberal arts courses. So where is this drive coming from? That's what they want to learn, that they're not getting somewhere else, or they want to learn about that. I just find that that's interesting in the MOOC world. So here's our Blueberry Man. So I'm just going to leave you with all these questions, and we can talk about this in the era of cultural diversification, educational diffusion, again, charter, private, public, and increasing technology, which theory will prevail? Do we continue to educate for the forest because that's the next generation that is going to be taking care of us and running our state and running our country? We have to care about education. Or do we care about the elite and making sure that there's an elite that at least will run things really well? Where do we spend all our money, knowing that children in poverty and the mushy blueberries over here cost twice as much to educate as a perfect blueberry does? Do we educate to work? Do we educate to think? How do we educate to determine our future? And what does this mean for the sustainability of humanity, not only in our country, but kind of across the world, where these same conversations are happening about education because this is happening everywhere. So I'm just going to end with no real conclusion, but I would certainly appreciate your comments and what your thoughts are.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. He's going to give me the microphone, even though I think so. I talk way too loud because I have to talk over this. But, I've spent many years, I have a PhD in chemistry. I did many years in research. Just starting this fall, I'm teaching a mile down the road at Lake Highlands High School. And they played a dirty trick on me. I'm doing forensic science, which is fun, but takes a lot of creativity, and I'm doing on-level chemistry. That was a revelation to me.
On-level chemistry?
Yeah.
You've got all the blueberries there.
Yeah, I got all the ones with mold on them.
Yes.
I could go on about not just every slide, but each and every bullet point is very valid. And there, I mean, education.
The pressures on you are enormous.
I know. You know, the instructional codes, that's something never had when I was down the road, when I went to school there. Mm-hmm. They never had, and they mm-hmm. are just all these many, many other jobs, including a battalion of police and so forth in the school. So there's many jobs in the school besides teaching, but, in terms of, I have so many questions here. I better pass it on. I'll find my best question here.
I'm a little bit confused, I guess.
Me too.
It seems to me, what you said, it goes along with what I've read quite a bit, a lot, is that we seem to be moving into a jobless culture. And if that's the case, and this may be what you were proposing, and that's what I'm asking, if that's the case, isn't a liberal education teaching people how to be creative and have fulfilled lives what we ought to be doing? Maybe not for this generation, but certainly for the next.
if it would engage those individuals.
But you pointed out that it does, that when people are able to make their own choices, that's what they choose.
That's not every student choosing. Those are students who are choosing to continue learning all the time. So that's not this much of the population, that's this much of the population.
So what do these choose?
What are they choosing?
Yeah.
What are the jobless people choosing to do out there?
What are they choosing to be educated about?
Well, what I can say is they're not choosing to be educated. That education is not their driver. But how should we educate them K-12? Because we have to educate them K-12.
Right.
So we're back to the forest. So you give them a smattering of, you have science and math, and you give them a smattering of things. But that, does that actually leave them with enough knowledge of anything to be successful at something or...
Or happy.
Or happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, comment on that. I think on some level, they're choosing to excel at video games in a way that is a skill that they are learning, perhaps at this stage useless for society, but it is a desire to improve one's skills, whether useless or not, but it's a desire to improve one's skills over a period of time and invest in that. And is there a way to maybe identify what it is that creates that drive in those people and directed in more socially productive ways than what computer gaming does today?
That's kind of what the gamification is doing.
I actually had a different question. That's okay. I'll let you talk to that.
That's really what gamification in education is about. You have, you buy certain curriculum and platforms and things where students get on, and they'll do practice of math problems and things like that.
Yeah, all the students got Chromebooks.
Chromebooks, I mean, you got the whole thing, and then they do their practice on those kinds of gaming platforms, which are not nearly as interesting as the games that they do at home, but, it's what we have in education. So we're trying to employ some of those methods that students find very appealing. It's very visual. It's fast. It's engaging. They get rewards. It's not always a bad thing. But that's, again, how they're learning outside the classroom. So that's now how we have to address them in the classroom. Otherwise, we lose them. You can't lecture any longer to students. That's just an anathema. You can't do that.
Okay, well, excellent presentation. I really enjoyed it. So if I was the genie and granted you three wishes, and pertaining to those children, those poor 5-year-olds that are showing up at the doorstep of your school, what would those two or three things be as far as helping to level the playing field? In other words, to have those 5-year-olds more equal in ability?
It would require, I know you don't want to hear the word money, but it would require money. What would I do with the money? I would have a year-round school for them. I would have much longer school days so that they're practically there all the time except they go home to sleep, because when they go home, there's nothing there for them. So I don't want to call it a boarding school kind of a system, but it's kind of like that, where you have much more time and influence on the child, and you a lot of physical and emotional behavior support that goes along with that. I would like to bring the parents in with part of that education, because that child's not going to succeed unless that family unit understands what is happening and supports what's going on. So those are some of the things that I would do, and I would... reading is so very, very important. I need them in preschool. I need them at 3. If you wait till 5, I've lost, 3 million words or something. Give them to me at 3. If you're not going to educate your child, at least give them to me at 3 so that I can have more of an influence. That's a little socialist kind of a thing that I'm not super comfortable with either, but you ask the question.
It seems to me that there's an dichotomy, a polarization, two sides to this coin of on the one hand, the parents of the child say, well, look, there's a forest, but there are pine trees and oak trees and blueberry trees. I mean, you know, one shoe doesn't fit all. So, you know, public school kind of dumps down to the average or even to the lowest common denominator. And, you know, so where does the bright student go? On the other hand, we got to take care of everybody. We want to educate. This is a democracy, so we want all of our electorate to be educated. So it seems to me that there's a balance here somewhere. Mm-hmm. Could there be kind of like a two-tier system? You know, father-in-law came from Germany, and he said, look, in Germany, not everybody went to university, you know, only the ones that were going to be, you know, doctors and lawyers went to university. Everybody else went to vocational school and learned to be, you know, mechanics or whatever.
They were happy doing that.
Yeah. So could we have kind of a two-tier education?
Well, we could, and that is kind of the European model, where about at grade 6, they take tests, and based on those tests, here's your pathway. That doesn't sit real well with the democratic kind of system. I'm sure you know people in your family or yourself maybe that, you know, in grade 6 you just weren't there, but later on the light bulb came on, you know? And so you shut a door on a child that doesn't always mesh with our feelings of equity and never giving up on a child. Or something you're talking about, probably what you had in your system, is you talk about a tier system. You have like an advanced track and you have a general ed track. Right? Well, that tracking is now losing favor in the state and across the nation because they feel that it still segregates students and keeps these students lower performing. So you have general ed class where you have everybody in there and you expect the teacher to take care of all these levels of students in a classroom where a high school teacher has over 100 students every day.
But it's still a tale of two cities because the gifted and talented, they're in the AP classes. They're going to the STEM school, they're doing the free AP, and then the people that are left over are all in one class where they keep the few that could go do better from the progressive.
In high school, you do have typically your AP classes and your pre-AP classes, but K through 8,
yeah.
You know, that's...
But you talk mostly about the kids. It seems to me that no one cares more about a child learning something than the parents. So it seems to me perhaps an effort should be made to get the parents involved in making sure their kids learn because they will know their kids, you know, foibles and all that kind of stuff, rather than the school trying to like take that role. So why don't we make more of an effort to get parents involved?
A lot of that anti-intellectualism comes from home.
Yes, I agree. But remember what I said about cultural diffusion. Not every culture wants the same thing. I have incredibly vocal parents that are at my door all the time. And you can probably guess what culture they come from.
Yep.
And I have parents who never enter my door.
That's right.
Yeah, I thought of Plano where they have the Asian kids, like the Chinese and the Indian. Okay, I did have a
question. You still
have I have more comments than questions. I'll come back to it, yeah. I have so many questions. Too many questions.
Talk about the gaming environment and immediate gratification. I'm not sure that's a new attribute of humans. I think a long time back, you look at a 2 or 3 year old, like y'all for candy, they want immediate gratification. So I think that that's always been there. And even within games, there's a certain idea of you've got short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. And I think if looking at gaming theory about how to entice someone in, and you can just close enough until you have to work harder to get over that hill, and it might be further put it down. So is there a thought to any type of gaming theory to the education to where you do have the short-term and the mid- and long-term goals?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I come down pretty hard on gaming, and I'm going to own that one. And so I get pushback from people who are like super gamers and say, Catherine, you got it all wrong. So I can appreciate some of what you're saying. that's, education is trying to learn from, that's what the gamification is about. They're trying to learn how can we put education on some kind of a platform with some kind of those systems in there that are very successful, that keep kids motivated. Even those who are unmotivated, they'll keep learning, keep learning, keep learning for the greater outcome. So I appreciate what you're saying. Yes, there are people who are constructing gaming educational systems right now.
I'd like to ask you, you talked about the difference in nationalism and nationalized
public school,
federal, yeah, level versus the local level. And I'd like to know your point of view on that, because it seems like it's very important, because, you know, people at the lower level say, I don't want somebody in Washington telling me how to educate my child or what the curriculum should be. On the other hand, you have a school districts like Highland Park versus Hogan High, you know, and that. So what's your idea?
I would like to see federal with some element of local control. But Common Core was tried, and look at it now, what a mess. Okay, that was the effort to have sustainable Common Core skills, right? And it's just been eaten alive by those who want states. So I don't think that that's going to work in our country. I don't think we're ever going to get to a federal system, because it wasn't started that way, and it's probably never going to be that way. And we probably won't accept it. But there are some really good things that happened from Common Core. There was some incredible curriculum, created by Common Core. Well, those assessments were so difficult, guess what? Students couldn't pass them.
Do you think there's going to be an increased federalization, more
control?
No,
because Betsy DeVos, less and less and less federal, and she wants it spread out. So it's even less than a federal, than what we've had now in the past.
So going kind of back to the blueberries, right, you end up with the moldy blueberries. So, and therefore you're starting with input into the system that's subpar and then attempting to make up for that. And you look at a lot of the developed world and even the developing world, they provide, so the society provides structured educational support for kids starting, you know,
preschool.
Early as one,
preschool.
Two, three, age one, two, or three, that then is available to all kids. In the U.S., unless you're upper middle class or rich, you can't afford preschool. It's prohibitively expensive. So your kids are going to go in some daycare where they make sure that, at best, but they just make sure that the kid doesn't die. That's about it, right? Versus wealthier individuals can take a child somewhere where they get exposure to the words and the learning and all of these things. And it comes back to the money that we're talking about.
There's some good news there for preschool in the state of Texas. The state of Texas is starting to pay for preschool. So, like in my district, we have a certain number of seats in our preschool program, which was like double this year, and we could have tripled it and still had kids who wanted to be there. Some seats set aside for those who were state-funded and some of those who were paid for. So we are starting to embrace that preschool as part of the
K-12. That kind of makes sure that the mold never grows on the
future. Yeah, we're trying to mitigate the mold. Yeah.
Okay. See if I can get this out right. So, looking at the bigger picture, and looking at the kind of big picture, and you were talking about
other countries and what they're doing. Is there a leader doing it a certain way? And it sounds like maybe like China?
Actually, New Zealand is kind of becoming the leader of education right now. They put in place a lot of things that we're actually studying quite a bit. They tend to be a forest. They're taking care of all kids. They tend to be slightly socialist about everyone is experiencing the same things. But their performance is very high. So there are some things going on in New Zealand that we're looking at.
I know that, what you just said. Yeah, I'm going to have a hard time getting this across. So they're small group of people.
Yeah, they're hobbits, you know.
Yeah. And I don't know, even if their education is really good, if they're going to be moving the world. So I just wondered if America wants to be competitive, is there somebody that's pushing education in a way that they're going to win the world?
Comparable in size is what you're saying.
How do you get it to scale?
To scale.
Mm-hmm. Because maybe we should keep our eye on that, if as a country, whatever they're doing, maybe we need to go in that direction and let it come from the top down.
The countries that we used to look to, basically European, you know, in the past 20 years, like your France and your Germany's, they're under the same kind of problems now because of immigration. Their whole system has been upended, and so they're struggling with many of the same things. Their systems, even the Indian system, is more, you separate kids earlier than we do. We're not, our democratic system does not want that to happen. Parents do not want that to happen. And there's some good things for not making that happen. You give kids education as long as they'll take it, but I don't believe that every child should be educated to go to college. I don't. There is some incredibly fantastic community college programming out there that is superb and actually far surpasses Brookhaven, thank you, which is one of our partners, far surpasses certain four-year college programming. So there's a lot that the community colleges are picking up that whole system, which is wonderful. They're becoming partners with K-12. So that has some real options and benefits to it, and they're expanding their programs. We have someone who's been a teacher at Brookhaven, and she can attest to that. Brookhaven, your Dallas Community College, your Richland, your Cullen colleges, they are expanding like crazy, and they are affordable to almost every student. And their programming is excellent. And they're very work-driven because that is their purpose. And, you know, it would be, I'm not even opposed to having, you know, free community college because it's so beneficial. And it's short-term, usually typically about a two-year program, and they are employable. And if they wanted to go on later on, they could. So I think that's a really, something we haven't talked about is the community college system. Particularly strong in the state of Texas, which is great. Not strong in every state.
Are you saying that that's what they're doing in perhaps China? Is that how they're doing it there?
I'm not an expert on that one, so I really can't speak to that.
I guess I'm just wondering who we're going to be competing with. Who's going to win? And again, what education system in running the world and being the winner is going to win in the end? Is there any education around it? I guess that was my question. Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to predict on that one. I don't know.
Let's not get a conversation.
Yeah.
We have
Matt
here.
Hi, thank you, Catherine. So I'm a product of the English education system, and back home, the national government sets the curriculum across the country, whereas I think what you're saying here is that it's determined a lot more by the state. Why is there such variation between the states? What's the...
Because the state, which is our TEA, Texas Education Association, sets the text of the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills. It says what students should know, but it doesn't say how to teach them that. It doesn't give you curriculum. So every district has to develop their own curriculum, or they buy it from another district, or they buy it from a company or something like that. And so districts want a curriculum that embraces their communities. And there's such variation in the state of Texas between a community here and a community here that, you know, the curriculum doesn't always mesh well. But that's why I mean a little bit on universality, because I kind of like a common, I like some common things in the state of Texas. It's interesting, the state of Texas, at least in the English department, has now come out with, believe it or not, first ever, a recommended list of student reading. Go figure, such a novel thing, oh my goodness. They have never, ever, ever done that, and I find it interesting that most of the titles on that list, especially for middle school students, are classics. They're things that you and I would recognize. I'm like, well, duh, you know. But what's been popular right now has been a lot of young adult fiction and the Divergent and all those kinds of readings, which really don't have the vocabulary, they really don't have the academic push that a classic does. So I find it interesting that the state of Texas has actually put out a list for the first time ever. So I think that they're seeing, at least in some academic areas, benefits of some commonality. But districts are not obligated to pick up those lists or use them. My district is not.
We have time for one more question.
You mentioned New Zealand, and I've also heard that Finland has always had an excellent education system, and many people thought it should be the model for the world.
Yes.
Then you mentioned that France and Germany seem to be going the other direction. Does this mean if you're a big country, the exception of a dictatorship like China or something of that nature, that you're done, you're not ever going to be able to solve this problem?
I don't know. But Finland was the model for a very, very long time, and I'm glad you brought that up. But they also had the least amount of diversity of their population. So when you have a diverse population, this is where public education struggles. And that's where you have the push and pull for all
other people. I've heard that if you factor out the poor people, is that 20% you were talking about, then America's not so bad compared to the rest of the world.
Actually, our test scores are doing really well.
And we're bringing people from all over the world that don't even speak English, and that's what making the whole country look bad. Not that we shouldn't educate them, but that should be a reality that Finland is a homogeneous country, and they only had trees and people. So they had to educate their people, and so that now they make Nokia cell phones.
Beware of averages. That's what test scores are all about, are averages, so beware of that. Okay.
One question. If you had a crystal ball, what would you predict, not in the next 4 years with this administration, but 20 years from now, where do you think it's going?
You're making her cry.
I know.
It's scary, right?
I know. I am very worried that we are going to lose any form of commonality in this country, and that is very dangerous to me. It's very dangerous to me that public federal funds can be used for any charter school that has any philosophy that can say no to any child over anything, and my public money will go there. That's a concern I have.
Thank you.
Sure.